Teresa, exactly. Nate, thanks very much for calling into KBOO. We missed you in the studio, but we appreciate that you were able to get in touch with us for the interview and all this great information.
You.
I want to tell people we've been talking with Teresa Rayford and Nate Cohn of Don't Shoot Portland, and they mentioned how to get involved with their very important work, especially over the next 4 years. They have a Facebook page, Don't Shoot Portland, and you can go to their website, don'tshootportland.com.
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7 is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 o'clock, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a little dose of listener comments. At 9 on Alternative Radio, it's Smoke and Fumes and Big Oil, the resistance to the corporate addiction to fossil fuelishness. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. At 11, on Stage and Studio, DeMay Roberts introduces us to the author of Everfair, a neo-Victorian alternate history novel. At 11:30, it's Art Focus, interviews with curators, critics, and artists. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. A reminder that all new and increased gifts to KBOO are matched one-to-one through the end of the year. Thanks to the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
Our KBOO Evening News production team for tonight is Joe Lino, Jacob Randall, Nicole Peltz, and me, Ken Jones. The producer's Lisa Loving. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. We don't usually do KBOO special event previews on the news, but we have a special one tonight. It was postponed from Thursday because of bad weather. It's the movie What Would Jesus Buy, featuring Reverend Billy. It's tonight, the Clinton Street Theater at 7 o'clock, so if you'd like to go, you got about an hour to go over there. It's an examination of the commercialization of Christmas in America while following Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping Gospel Choir on a cross-country mission to save Christmas from the shop-pocalypse, which is the end of humankind from consumerism, overconsumption, and the fires of eternal debt. You've been listening again to the KBOO Evening News. I'm Ken Jones. I'm here with Joe Lino. Thanks, Danielle.
On Friday, December 16th, join From the Grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and commentary, on our special Christmas Soul Show. Local and national political commentary provided by Landon Crowell, and always musical analysis by our art historian, Diane Johnson. So join From the Grassroots, December 16th from 8 p.m. until 10 on 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland. We'll be very special
Christmas. To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio. Tonight, we'll be listening to a talk by Joe Allen on the logistics revolution, UPS, and who will move the world. A talk given at the Socialism 2016 conference this July in Chicago.
But he said after World War II, you know, amateur study, strategy, professional study, logistics, because is that one of the things that they learned from the Second World War is that you couldn't win a war simply by military means. You had to have the industrial production and know-how to get that to the front to win. Now, maybe they always knew that, but when you had the greatest global war in history, It actually reveled in the level of American corporate involvement was on such a scale that they then brought what they learned back to the civilian sector of the economy. Now, this logistics revolution doesn't take place in isolation from other things that over in the 50 years after the Second World War that play an important part in shaping what happens and furthering, pushing it forward and so forth. So if you think about what the United States was like after World War II, and this may come to a shock to people, there were no cell phones, there were no barcodes, there was no GPS, there was no satellite system. In fact, the roads were pretty terrible. It was a very primitive country in some ways. The war, World War II, and the New Deal began a process of kind of moving things in this direction. But it's really the post-war world that that really reshapes what becomes the foundations for the logistics revolution in the United States. And the most important of that was the interstate highway system, what I referred to in the beginning, the development of the, you know, under the National Defense Highway Act, which really kind of changes the whole feel and scope and transportation and business in the United States. And along with that were also pretty important earth-shaking political events. And, you know, obviously the collapse of Stalinism much later in the late 1980s, the rise of China as sort of the workshop of the world, the transportation, a transportation revolution as well as logistical revolution kind of propel forward these changes. And one thing that played an hugely important role, though so it's so mind-bogglingly simple, was the development of the container. If you want to read a book that kind of focuses on that, that kind of gives you the scope of how one thing can help that was thought of before, but you get a few other political and economic changes and it propels it forward, is read the book The Box. It's really fascinating about the history of the container. The one thing that was an important political development in the United States, which still sticks very much in the minds of trade unionists and socialists, is of course the historic deregulation of the trucking, the aviation, and the finance industries in the United States in the late 1970s and 1980s. It's interesting when you read about that period because it wasn't something that the industries demanded. In fact, the industries themselves opposed, by and large, the deregulation of the industry because they had a good deal. You know, they had this, Ralph Nader described it as crony capitalism. And he was absolutely right. Actually, Nader was also for the deregulation of these industries at the time because he thought that that would lead to lower prices. And he later regretted the decision that they made. When you look at the debates from the late 70s, because a lot of this is in the context of inflation at the time, so competition gets rid of inflation, one author from that era says that, well, very few people said this publicly, that it was well understood that part of deregulating the trucking industry was to break the Teamsters Union. And they very successfully did that in freight eventually. Now, of course, all of this, like with the National Defense Highway Act, took place with the major capitalist powers also sponsoring, you know, major changes in terms of how the economy was organized, not only through deregulation, but things like, you know, creating the massive port systems for containerization. If you go to Long Beach in LA, San Pedro, New Jersey, if you come to Chicago, you know, all of the major logistics centers in the United States, is that none of this couldn't have been done without billions of dollars of state-sponsored money to make all of this happen. One of the things about the development of the logistics revolution is not only does it create these sort of new centers or takes old centers and completely refashions them in order to move goods around the world, is that it also has meant that these centers, these sort of logistics clusters, you know, if you think that there's bland language in most business journals, read stuff about logistics, you know, logistics clusters in the United States were up around the major transportation points. Is that manufacturing and distribution centers have grown up around them. You know, Walmart itself has huge, you know, has huge hubs. UPS has huge hubs. You know, they UPS has a major, you know, air facility in Louisville, Kentucky, called Woolport, which, you know, it's a kind of nice name. FedEx calls theirs the Super Hub, which is a kind of cool name. And in each one of these places, you have major manufacturers and distributors has set up operations, so they have direct connection to these places. But there, while they may be the most visible of them, there's actually 65 identifiable logistics clusters in the United States that employ over 3 million people, and really in what are the major potential areas for workers' power and choke points in this country. I mean, you can, the most notable are across New York, New Jersey, Chicago, which is the largest inland port in the world, and Long Beach, LA. But if I said to you Alliance, Texas, with the exception of Mike Corwin, everybody go, huh, where, what, what's that? And of course, that's a major logistics cluster north of Fort Worth. About 45,000 people work there. It's owned by Ross Perot Jr. And if you look at their brochure that they use to sell why you should build your warehouse and your factory there, they say we have a large population that will be growing in the future, i.e. we have a lot of immigrant workers who have big families. And that's what they straightforwardly, they say that stuff. And if you look at any of these logistics clusters across the country, they're very familiar people, Walmart, Sears, Target, so forth and so on. But really, it's really the core of the industrial economy. It's all based around these right now. Nelson Lichtenstein, in his book on Walmart, which everyone should read, The Retail Revolution by Nelson Lichtenstein, talks about how the earth is now girded with these massive distribution centers. And I would just say it's the same thing with, you would add to that, these logistics clusters that, and this is really what modern industrial capitalism and distribution is. I mean, you know, we're not going to go back to the days when Sears was the only department store. I mean, the world has really changed on this stuff. Now, one of the things about, you know, and if you go, for example, if you just walk down the street here, you'll see the beginning of Route 55, which is just right south of here. And Route 55 extends out through the southwest side of Chicago, the southwest suburbs, all the way out to these places that just a few years ago were essentially farm towns, Romeoville, Yorkville, blah, blah, blah. And that is the major logistics cluster throughout for Chicago. So, for example, the biggest facility there is the Chicago area consolidated hub of UPS, where Donnie works. We're at peak season, there's about what, Donnie? 7,000, 8,000 people work there at the height of these things. And one of the things that Kim Moody in particular makes a point about, which is again taking the familiar and looking at it a different way, is that we've come to assume that the big metropolitan areas have been emptied of industrial workers. Now, on one hand, if you look south to what used to be U.S. Steel, that looks true. If you look west to the west side of Chicago, where did all those factories go? But if you look to the southwest and you see the catch with 8,000 people, if you look to the old Joliet arsenal, again, an example of where the military and the civilian logistics overlap, you see tens of thousands of people employed in all of these industries. So in some sense, what's been happened is the logistics revolution has created a new industrial working class in this country and around the world. Now, the one company that I want to emphasize, because I know it the best, and it's just the book I just wrote, is about United Parcel Service. And I want to talk about what's important about it and what's also unique about it. Like I said at the beginning, one of the things that you look at with the logistics industries across the United States and the world is they tend to almost be entirely non-union, or at best partially unionized. So for example, FedEx overwhelmingly is non-union, except for its pilots, for example. And that's interesting because pilots are not only important for FedEx's operations, but you can't just hire a pilot off the street. You know, man? You know what I'm saying? You know. So that there's also a heavy overlap between military service and then getting jobs in the civilian industry when it comes to things like pilots. I mean, almost all pilots are former Air Force or Navy veterans. I've never met one who wasn't, let's put it that way. But on the other hand, you also have the West Coast dockers and the East Coast dockers who are unionized and very important. But when you go to like the vast swath of the country, you know, Walmart, FedEx, Target, and the whole Inland Empire in California is virtually non-union. And in fact, if you look at the latest listings from Transport Topics, which is the magazine put out by the American Trucking Association, they'll list the top 100 trucking companies, for example, in the United States. And in the top five, there were two. One's UPS, the other is YRC, which used to be Yellow Freight. You have to get to 21 before you find the next one, and then another 10 before. So you get a sense of how deunionized the industry has become, or it was non-union from the very, very beginning. UPS sticks out because, and I'll try to explain a little bit why, because it is now the largest unionized private sector employer in the country. It occupies a position akin to what General Motors used to be. I mean, in some sense, when General Motors had 300,000 UAW employees, that was the largest single unionized private sector employer in the world. UPS now has that position. The Teamsters and mostly, there's some machinists who represent mechanics in a few places, but they're overwhelmingly Teamsters. And there's 250,000 members of the Teamsters at UPS. UPS, on a daily basis, moves 6% of the U.S. Gross domestic product and moves 2% of the world domestic product. FedEx roughly moves the same sort of stuff. So between these two companies, on a daily basis, they move an incredible amount of the gross domestic product of the United States and the world, a world economy. UPS probably, and I'm sure somebody write on Facebook that I'm wrong about this, that it's probably now the oldest continuous trucking company in the country. Many others are bought out, went bankrupt, became something else, operate under another brand. UPS was founded in 1907. As a bicycle messenger service, and as I try to, when I talk to different audiences about this, is how do you understand how a bicycle messenger service in Seattle, Washington, becomes a company that not only moves 6% of the U.S. GDP, but delivers overnight packages to 220 countries around the world on a daily basis? How does that happen? Well, that wasn't part of the plan in 1907. The company was founded by, James Casey, known as Jim, because at UPS, we're all on a first name basis. And get the big handshake. Hi, Joe. Hi, Jim. And I may go a little bit longer, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
And the thing about Casey is he's probably one of the most obscure of people who are one of the most important capitalists in the history of the United States. Part of it was timing. He shared the personality with a John D. Rockefeller or a Henry Ford. He was sort of this austere kind of odd guy with a kind of flinty personality. When he would take vacations, he would go visit UPS hubs on his vacation. This is somebody that we call a fanatic. And then somebody, of course, responded, fanatics need to build a world. Well, we really don't need fanatics to build a world, but that's kind of the way it happened with some people. It started out as a fairly modest business. It bought it for its trucks at the 19-teens. And it was, for the most part, a kind of boutique delivery service for department stores. So people would go and you buy your packages, and they would get all bundled up, and UPS would deliver them. And of course, when I'm reading all of this, because we live in a different world, right, with all this stuff, is that when I'm reading this, I kind of go, why didn't people just take their packages home? Maybe I'm missing some big thing here. But that was one of the things that the department stores offered. It was part of the glamour of shopping, right? And UPS was very good at it. It was very, very good at it. And it developed a niche market. It grew down the West Coast during the 1920s, and it made this big leapfrog into the New York market in the 1930s. And in fact, the reason why I knew so much about UPS in the 1930s is because they not only leapt into New York fairly early in their history, but they became a kind of delivery service from the middle class, which means that the press writes about them.
This is KBOO Portland. You've been listening to a talk by Joe Allen called Logistics Revolution, UPS, and Who Will Move the World.
So there's lots of articles on UPS and the New York Times and the New Yorker, of all things. And you know something about their history about that. They did that type of business up until the 1950s when, with the suburbanization of shopping, people just had cars and they didn't need any longer to have delivery companies bring their packages to them. In many ways, UPS, because it's now the oldest continuously functioning company in the country, freight company in the country, you can sort of chart the history of transportation through their history. They were forced very quickly to become a more general freight company, but they focused on small, lightweight packages. And they basically, all of their distribution centers, what we call hubs at UPS, the Royal We, is they were basically fairly standard and modeled one after another. And they became very good at doing that sort of business for the next 25 years. At that time, you know, the trucking and aviation were heavily regulated, which meant that you had to win a state-by-state approval in order to move into a various states. And even then, they regulated where you could go in the states. This is the kind of world that is really lost to us. I mean, it's just gone, right? And it wasn't until 1976 that UPS could actually deliver to the 48 contiguous states of the continent, and then they also got rights to Alaska and Hawaii. That's one phase of the history of the company, when it was a boutique delivery service, then it was a general freight company, and then from the 1980s onward, it moves into becoming much the biggest transportation company in the world, and it does that by taking on FedEx, who almost stole the business from them, and UPS creates its own airline in the late 1980s, specializes in overnight delivery of packages. And to this day, and today, I believe, depending on the time of year, because there's always a little bit of, you know, variation on this because of seasonal stuff, it is now the ninth largest private airline in the world, with one of the largest unionized workforces. When you look at chart UPS's history of the transport industry throughout the 20th century, but it also mirrors the labor movement of the 20th century. Too. Even though the Teamsters were very small, they got in early in the 20s, and probably in the Bay Area, as much as I can track it down, it was in the Bay Area first that they went, the Teamsters got in. But very early on, Jim Casey made a deal with the Teamsters, he could represent their workers. And of course, part of the deal was, you treat me well and I'll treat you well. In fact, the growth of UPS would be impossible, particularly over the last 40 years, without the major concessions that were given to UPS, particularly around wages and around the destruction of full-time jobs in favor of part-time jobs. There's a huge story there, and people should ask a lot of questions about it, because UPS became known for pioneering part-time work in the United States, and then taking that around the globe, and along with the creation of a 2- and 3-tier. I mean, Donnie, what would you say? Is there a 6-tier wage structure now at UPS? It's just impossible to sort of follow in some ways, which has been an enormous subsidy to the company if you look at what the Teamsters provided. At the same time, UPSers throughout their history have attempted to fight back against these things and shape the workplace in their own way. Sometimes these were local struggles. In New York, they were led by Ron Carey and this very independent-minded local 804. Or the more famous, which was the 1997 UPS strike, which was the biggest labor victory to 20 years previous to that. Its slogan was Part-Time America Won't Work. I can't get into the strike in any great detail, but if people want to ask questions about it, please do. It's also true that transport workers, whether they're Teamsters or dock workers or airline workers or railroad workers, and this is very true of what the aftermath of the U.S. The UPS strike, is they've also been subject to some of the most suffocating labor legislation in the country and have been a focal point of political repression by the federal government. So Ron Carey wins the biggest labor victory in 20 years. He's soon after witch-hunted out of the union, where a much more compliant figure, James Hoffa Jr., is elected to the presidency and has been with us for 17 years since then and has reverted back to a kind of cooperation with the company. But if you look at the big picture on the history of repression against transport worker unions, There was a Get Eugene Debs campaign after the Pullman strike. There was the Get Harry Bridges campaign, who was the militant who led a 20-year campaign to get rid of Bridges, who led the West Coast Dockers. There was a campaign, a Get Hoffa Senior campaign. So all of these people are very different in personality and politics, but what they all have in common is that they were known at one point in their lives as being militant workers at the heart of what we now call the logistics area of the economy. UPS also is known for, of course, it's famously for its faux military culture. You bleed brown, that's one of the slogans. I used to joke that the company's slogan was paint the world brown. It's not paint the world brown, but it's kind of like that, you know. And, you know, there's when you read some of the more fawning histories of UPS by their former managers, there's a few, they'll talk about how their training program for drivers in particular, they turn out people better than machines, and that's something that they're proud of. I don't know if that means you don't break down. Most drivers break down. But they have this kind of idea of turning people into literally robots. And it's also one of the most politically powerful corporations in Washington. Now, with the Citizens United ruling a couple of years ago, there's this huge amount of money that floods into politics. It kind of disguises the fact that companies like UPS are major campaign contributors and very big players in Washington. And infamously, they tried to destroy OSHA in the 1990s, which was their huge political initiative. UPS, I think, today is a very important company for the future of the labor movement, not simply just preserving it as a unionized company, because, like I said, it sticks out from the rest of logistics economy by being a unionized company, and it's everywhere. So if you're in Maine, or you're in Hawaii, you're in Texas, you're in Florida, you're here, you know, you're probably in the Teamsters Union. It has national scope and very important, and we learned how important that was during the 97 strike, when during the three-week strike, we knocked 2% growth off of the U.S. economy doing that. And for people who are interested in getting decent paying, you know, jobs as a driver, it takes a while to become a driver, you know, UPS is everywhere, you know. When you think back to sort of discussions about the socialist and the labor movement from either in the 20s, 30s, or in the 70s, UPS is not a regional industry. Logistics is not a regional industry. It's everywhere with key places, but it is everywhere. Now, what does this mean really kind of for today and the practical realities of how big the socialist left is and how weak the trade union movement is in this country, particularly the industrial wing of the trade union movement? Well, I think there's a couple of things, big questions and immediate questions to think about. The more immediate one is that there's an election issue in the Teamsters Union. After 17 years of Hoffa, there's a possibility that he may be voted out of power. There is a reform slate running against him, headed up by Fred Zuckerman, who had been at one time a Hoffa supporter, but famously broke with them several years ago, challenged his slate 5 years ago in an election, led a campaign to vote down the last UPS contract, which was seen. I haven't found a UPSer who's happy with the last contract that they had. Major concessions on health care, job progression, wage progression, all sorts of things that people are very angry about. There's a huge crisis in the Teamsters around pensions. What had been the most famous pension in the United States, the Central States Pension Fund, is now bankrupt, where retirees, about 400 retirees, are facing pension cuts from previously getting $3,000 a month, possibly down to as low as $900 over the next year. I mean, this is impoverishing poor elderly people. I mean, there's going to be a catastrophe in the wake of when this happened. That issue itself may be the millstone that drags it down. But I also tend to think that elections are things for the incumbents to lose. So I want to be a little cautious about that. So if there's a change in the political leadership of the Teamsters Union, that would be a very welcome change. We'll see that. 2 years from now, is the national and local UPS contracts all come up for negotiations. And there's a kind of sense that much of the campaigning around low wages, which in some ways the UPS strike of 97 is one parent of. It may be an absent parent in the minds of most people, but for those of us who look a little bit longer at these issues, I think it's definitely a parent of the kind of Fight for 15 movement right now, is that bringing those struggles that we've seen in the retail industry into a place like UPS, which for 30 years the start pay was $8 an hour, and it was raised to 10. That's thank you very much. But if you can bring that type of campaign into UPS around raising, getting rid of the poverty wages, a campaign around full-time jobs, not only could that reinvigorate the Teamsters Union, which desperately needs some reinvigoration, but you can kind of take, you know, that campaign and bring it into the rest of the logistics economy. Ron Carey, the former president, said it very well years ago. You know, you can't organize new workers if you're selling out your old ones. I mean, it's pretty sensible. The employers know that. That's why they, you know, carry out very effective anti-union campaigns. Most of the time, they don't have to lie about anything. They just tell you the truth about the reality of some unions are like. It's terrible to say, but I think that's true. The other is, of course, a more long-term question. You know, I graduated from high school in 1978. What a lousy year to graduate, because all we had was misery for the next 30 years afterwards. And Brackett goes broke, you know, new wars, you know, like Reagan, you know, so like, and you know, during that time, of course, we've seen these gut-wrenching changes to the economy that have been brought about, I think we now understand, because of the logistics revolution, you know. And, you know, I still have very vividly in my mind, remember, the steel mills not just simply being closed, but blown up. This is not coming back. You know, I remember going to a labor notes conference in Detroit about 10 years ago and just going past one empty factory after another, and just being utterly depressed about what had been a symbol of, you know, pride of union jobs and union power, just gone. You go to the west side of Chicago to this very day, you know, you go up Grand Avenue, just, you know, still one shuttered building after another. And so when you're a socialist growing up in that era, you know, the whole idea of trying to argue that the industrial working class is the motor force for socialist revolution seems a bit vague or distant, and you rely on history. Well, no, let me tell you about what happened in 1914 somewhere to show, you know, I mean, not to disparage it, but, you know, you gotta have something in hand for people. You know, most people are pretty practical about, well, what are you really trying to do? And so I think politically, I think we can talk about a group of a new industrial working class that can actually has the power to shut down the system. It has the potential power